The whole world may be focused on COVID-19, but natural disasters don't seem to care.
There is a pretty big concern here about capacity. These agencies have already been working nonstop since the pandemic began.
I'm Matt Katz, in for Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway for Wednesday, May 20th, a look at how the pandemic is affecting our natural disaster preparedness. Then contact tracing. What is it, really, and how does it work?
That time between diagnosis and actually doing an initial case interview to identify the contacts and then reaching out to those contacts really has to move quickly.
And we visit New Zealand to see how they're responding to the crisis.
The message was, if you've got the slightest sniffle, get tested. And since that has happened, testing numbers have increased quite rapidly.
Let's get started.
Coronavirus and this storm is gonna really hit us.
We got rained off the beach today, but this is the first time this month.
I'm hoping it blows over, but if it doesn't, we're just gonna kind of hunt the dawn because we're here for the next week.
This week, Tropical Storm Arthur kicked off 2020's hurricane season well before the projected start date of June 1st. The storm made its way up the southeastern coastline of the U.S., and though it was short-lived, it dumped heavy rain on parts of North Carolina. Arthur is the first of many possible storms to come as hurricane season gets underway. And as the U.S. still struggles to get the coronavirus pandemic under control, experts worry about the impact on disaster preparedness in the coming months. And it's not just hurricanes and tropical storms on their minds. On the West Coast, wildfire season has been devastating over the last few years, and it could be even worse this year, with warnings of an earlier start to the season in parts of California. We're going to talk about it. I'm Matt Katz, in for Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway. We're joined by Jacob Margolis, science reporter at KPCC in Los Angeles covering disasters there, and Samantha Montano, an assistant professor of the Massachusetts Maritime Academy and a self-described disasterologist. Samantha says there are a few ways the pandemic is complicating our preparedness for natural disasters like hurricanes and wildfires.
It's affecting everything about how we prepare for other disasters that happen during this pandemic. So it affects everything that we do to prepare for disasters that requires people to be in close proximity to one another. The economic consequences of this pandemic presumably have an effect on individuals' ability to buy supplies for hurricane season, to kind of pay for all of those things that fall under this preparedness category. Similar situation in terms of local and state governments being able to afford those preparedness efforts.
For other disasters, and those could be, what kind of other disasters might they be looking for funds to prepare for?
Sure. So hurricane season is coming up. We already have Arthur out in the Atlantic Ocean right now, but the official start date is June 1st. So that is definitely a type of hazard that's on everyone's mind. But this also includes wildfires, earthquakes, river flooding, terrorist attack, any kind of natural or man-made hazard that could come up in the next few months.
Of those, are there any disasters that are more challenging than others to prepare for right now?
One thing that matters here is scale. So for kind of large scale emergencies or smaller disasters that are handled much more locally, you know, there's all the same challenges of figuring out how you're going to respond while social distancing. But I do think that larger scale disasters, something like a Hurricane Harvey or a Hurricane Maria, do pose kind of a particular challenge because they affect such a large area and require so many different organizations and communities to come together to work with one another. I think there's just kind of some added challenges there.
Now, Jacob, you cover disasters like wildfires and earthquakes, given that you're based in California. How are state and local governments out there preparing for those potential disasters while we're in the middle of this pandemic?
There are two majorly different things, obviously. For wildfires, Governor Newsom just proposed a revised budget for this next year. And it looks like Cal Fire, the state firefighting agency, is going to get a ton of money. They're ramping up the number of people that they have. They're getting 26 new Wildland firefighting trucks, which are these big metal boxes that trundle along through these huge walls of flames. Basically, they're pretty amazing. And they're also getting 12 Black Hawk helicopters. They're going to basically pick up over the next few months, and those to let them fly at night, fly faster, carry more water and such. So clearly fighting wildfires is a priority, and they're investing a lot of money in doing that, both at the state level and on a local level. When it comes to earthquakes, I did a piece a couple of months ago about what would happen if a big one hit right now. And the answer is complicated. The assumption is that we're actually probably in a better place in terms of shelter in place, which is the best thing to do for earthquakes. It's also good that most people are at home, because single family homes, which are prevalent in Southern California in particular, tend to do better in big earthquakes than, say, office buildings that people may be stuck in. So there's a lot of different factors that go into considering kind of the fallout from these multiple disasters. But like Samantha talked about, also just everyone being overwhelmed by the pandemic sort of adds a level of concern that could obviously stress those available resources, even though we're investing money in them.
And is it expected to be a bad wildfire season in California this year?
Yeah, so right now, because of late season rains in March and April, and now it's raining a little bit in May, our wildfire risk in Southern California is actually fairly low right now. Up in Northern California, they missed out on a lot of the same precipitation that we got down here, so the wildfire risk is a lot higher up there. They have a lot more forests up there. Really, over the next few months, we'll be able to tell how things are going to shake out. It depends on how hot and how relentless summer is and how soon those Santa Ana winds come along, because stuff really tends to dry out by the fall. And then Santa Ana winds, the devil winds, you know, that we get hit with, that we talk about every single year over here on the West Coast, they hit us. And those are really what push those major, major, major fires along, because when they're there, you cannot stop those fires.
Samantha, wanted to talk about what's happening at the federal level. What's the role of the emergency management agency that we're most familiar with, FEMA, right now? What is its responsibility during this pandemic, and how does that affect the other work that FEMA does?
So about mid-March, the Trump administration announced that FEMA would be taking on the coordinating role for the federal agencies that are involved in the response. That's as opposed to HHS or the White House Task Force or Jared Kushner's Task Force. So FEMA has been pretty central to the coordination of the response. A lot of the work that they've been doing has focused on PPE and getting that equipment out across the country. So, you know, that has taken up a lot of their resources. They have said repeatedly that they are still having staff work on, you know, making changes to their plans for hurricane season, and still, you know, have staff paying attention to these other hazards across the country.
Is there any parallel to this moment, Samantha? Have we ever had to contend with multiple disasters at once before, like what we might expect if this pandemic continues for some time?
Kind of. So we've definitely had disasters happen at the same time across the country or in close proximity to one another across the country. A kind of obvious recent example is the 2017 hurricane season, where we had Harvey, Irma, and Maria all right after each other, kind of around the same time as wildfires in California. There, you know, is precedent in that sense. There is not precedent, though, for every single emergency management agency at all levels of government across the country being activated at the same time, which is essentially what has happened in the past couple of months as those agencies try to respond to the pandemic.
So what are the concerns about what would happen if there is another emergency, another disaster, and all of these agencies that are already, you know, expending their resources have to contend with another disaster?
Yeah, so I think there is a pretty big concern here about capacity. Like you said, these agencies have already been working nonstop since the pandemic began in various ways to help respond to the pandemic. To add another disaster on top of that is, you know, clearly a really big challenge, especially when you keep in mind, you know, a place like New York City has a huge emergency management agency with hundreds of employees, a big budget, compared to most emergency management agencies across the country, which, you know, especially in rural areas, may just have a part-time emergency manager. So kind of the capacity of these various agencies is going to look very different across the country. And you could see where a smaller emergency management agency could be pretty easily overwhelmed. The other issue here is not just the capacity at the local level, but also looking at the capacity across the country. Our approach to responding to events very much relies on help coming in from surrounding communities, from surrounding states. And to the extent that those surrounding communities are dealing with the pandemic themselves or have concerns about how to come and help safely, that kind of convergence of help that usually shows up after a disaster may be delayed or look different than it usually does because of the pandemic.
On a local level over here, the potential fallout from a major earthquake is very well documented. It's been studied by USGS scientists as well as others. And the concern that I heard when I talked to some folks about what if a big one hit right now was our immediate response might be okay. People might know what to do. We'll eventually be able to put out all the fires. We'll eventually be able to provide shelter to people. We're sure that, you know, the Red Cross will likely be able to come in or other agencies will come in. But then the question becomes one of long-term recovery. If you're already trying to deal and with a pandemic, what does it mean when, say, Riverside County needs a ton of new sewer lines that they need to import from China? They might not have that metal on hand already, whereas LA does. And there are going to be these long-term things that are going to be complicated also by supply chains that are having some issues.
Samantha, what are you hearing from emergency managers about that, about the long-term recovery part of this crisis and then coupled with potentially other crises?
Recovery from a large-scale event on our best day is really, really complicated. And we actually already have a pretty good sense of what recovery is going to look like from any event that comes up in the next couple of months, because we already have ongoing recoveries across the country from previous disasters. So there was some good reporting done by Adam Wagner in North Carolina about how Hurricane Florence's recovery has come to, in some ways, a standstill as folks have needed to shelter at home. The nonprofit sector is a huge support during recovery. And many of those national disaster nonprofits that work in recovery have had to pause their operations because of the pandemic. So there's some really significant challenges as we get into recovery. There's a lot of room for concern.
There were also some pretty deadly tornadoes in recent months, too, and I imagine the recovery for those is ongoing.
The tornadoes that have happened in the past couple months have damaged hundreds of homes across the country. Usually after an event like a tornado, we see this convergence of volunteers. We call them spontaneous volunteers, in addition to those, you know, more disaster-specific nonprofits that come into communities. And from the reporting that I've seen related to those tornadoes, there have been people who have come to help and to come volunteer, but the work that they've done has had to be done while integrating physical distancing. And I have the sense that they haven't really quite been able to get as much done as they would have been able to do if there was not a pandemic.
Samantha Montano is an assistant professor at the Massachusetts Maritime Academy, and Jacob Margolis is a science reporter at KPCC. Thanks to you both for the great conversation.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
As COVID-19 has devastated businesses, many hoped something called business interruption insurance would be able to help out. But that hasn't been the case, as insurance companies are denying potentially billions of dollars in claims. Nearly one-third of all businesses in the U.S. have business interruption insurance, which Elizabeth Blossfield, East Region Editor of the Insurance Journal, describes this way.
Business interruption insurance will typically cover a business owner if there is a loss as a result of property damage. So, for example, if a restaurant has a fire and it damages some of the equipment inside and it needs to shut down for a few weeks for repairs, it can call in its business interruption insurance to recoup some of the lost business in that situation.
But insurance companies are saying there's been no physical damage caused by the virus, even as some businesses argue that the virus is damaging surfaces by making them untouchable. Businesses across the country are now filing lawsuits against their insurers, fighting these claim denials, including famed chefs Wolfgang Puck and Thomas Keller. And now states are getting involved. Six states have proposed legislation that would make insurance companies pay out these business interruption insurance claims. Elizabeth Blossfield says understanding all of this requires going back to the SARS outbreak of 2002-2003.
After the SARS outbreak, I think the insurance industry really decided that a virus is too unpredictable of a risk to insure because each virus is different and the scope of damage and the extent of loss could be too great. The insurance industry really likes to anticipate risk. So with something like a natural disaster, for example, like a hurricane or a wildfire, you know, insurers can look at historical data for a particular region to better understand the expected outcome or impact to their clients if a future event were to occur. But with a virus, it can be slightly unpredictable. Each virus, you know, is different. It's difficult to predict from past events what the impact of a future viral outbreak will be. So the insurance industry decided to exclude virus and bacteria-related losses from business interruption policies in most cases.
After September 11th, 2001, insurance companies excluded losses due to terrorism from business interruption insurance. And then, like you said, they excluded viruses and bacteria right after the SARS outbreak in 2002-2003. Do you think there'll be any changes that will be made to business interruption insurance policies after this pandemic?
You know, that's a good question. It's one that I've thought about a lot as well. What I've heard from the insurance industry is that coverage like this is such a niche area that it's one of those things that business owners may not realize they need until they really, really need it. For example, like during this coronavirus pandemic. So in the past, when there have been a couple of insurers that have tried to, you know, build a pandemic policy out for customers, and it just wasn't selling.
I imagine it didn't sell because people weren't expecting a global pandemic. So there didn't seem like there'd be a need for insurance against it, right?
Exactly. It's one of those things that you can't really anticipate happening, and you might not realize that you need the coverage for until it actually happens and you're without coverage.
Right, right. Many businesses have filed lawsuits against their insurers for denying these kinds of claims. Have you seen any of the lawsuits related to the virus? And what are some of the arguments that they might be making for why insurers should be covering COVID-19 losses under business interruption insurance?
I have seen some of these lawsuits, and some of the attorneys on behalf of their business owner clients are claiming that because the insurance policy doesn't contain a specific virus exclusion, that it should be covered. You know, others are claiming that there is a physical damage component because of the contamination. You know, a virus can attach itself to a surface for, they're saying, with this virus up to 72 hours in some cases. And so they're claiming that the policy language, you know, is ambiguous and it doesn't specify whether there's visible or invisible property damage, and contamination can be considered an invisible damage. You know, I've even seen some lawsuits where they're claiming that the virus may have infiltrated a building's ventilation system, and in that way it's contaminating the air, and that could be considered a physical damage component. I think it's too early to tell whether these arguments will hold weight or how it'll play out, but it's definitely a good question.
New York, New Jersey, Massachusetts, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Louisiana, they're all proposing legislation that would make insurance retroactively cover COVID-19 losses. How would that work? Do you know? Have you looked at any of those proposals?
Yeah, I've spoken to a few of the legislators who have proposed these bills in various states, and their concern is really about assisting businesses, you know, especially restaurants who have lost a large part of their business to this virus, and small businesses where an extended shutdown could even put them out of business. They're really trying to call on the insurance industry to step in and help with some of these financial difficulties. For the insurance industry, on the other hand, you know, it's held firm with its stance that business interruption coverage wasn't designed to cover virus-related losses. They're saying it's too big of a risk that the industry wasn't able to price for. So if it retroactively has to go back and pay for some of these losses that it wasn't able to price for, it would be a huge financial hit to the insurance industry. And I know that the insurance industry has also raised questions about the constitutionality of legislation like this, saying that it could conflict with the Contracts Clause in Article 1 of the U.S. Constitution, which says that states can't interfere with private contracts. The argument like that, I think that business owners and insurers definitely have great points, and it'll be interesting to see how it plays out. You know, I know that the legislation that's been proposed in various states, none of it has passed as of yet. So it'll be interesting to see if other states follow suit and what will ultimately end up happening.
Does some of the legislation seem to have legs? Does some of the legislation seem to have a potential of passing?
You know, it's very early stages right now. When I talk to people who work in the insurance industry, they seem to think that the legislation just doesn't really hold any weight and it's eventually not going to pass. You know, speaking with business owners and attorneys that represent them, you know, they're still holding out hope that the insurance industry can come in and help out with some of these costs. So I think it's a little early to say which side will ultimately win out, but we'll see.
Elizabeth Blossfield is the East Region Editor for the Insurance Journal. Elizabeth, thanks so much for your reporting and for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, everybody. I'm Matt Katz, and this is The Takeaway. While research into a COVID-19 vaccine is being fast-tracked by a number of companies around the world, we're still at least months away from a publicly available pharmaceutical solution to the virus. But public health agencies do have another tool that they say is key to containing the virus until a vaccine is ready, and that's contact tracing. It's a process that involves calling patients who have tested positive for coronavirus and determining who they came in close contact with while they were contagious. The contact tracers then reach out to those people and advise them to quarantine for the next 14 days. It's a difficult job, particularly given the speed in which COVID-19 spreads. And to meet the demand, states are currently hoping to add thousands of contact tracers to their workforces. Joining me now to talk about all of this is Angela Clendenin, Instructional Assistant Professor in Epidemiology and Biostatistics at the Texas A&M University School of Public Health. Thank you for being here, Angela.
Oh, thank you very much.
Angela, what is the purpose of contact tracing and how exactly does it work?
When you're dealing with a disease, obviously it's something that spreads in a community that you really can't see, smell, touch, or taste. And so contact tracing is really taking somebody that we know has the disease because they've been diagnosed, and then trying to almost build a perimeter around them by talking to the people they've been in close contact with, and getting them isolated away and watching them for symptoms so that we're building this fence around the disease and keeping it from spreading any further. It's a public health mitigation effort that has been used for years and years and is really effective.
What are some of the main challenges that COVID-19 specifically poses when it comes to doing contact tracing?
So a few of the challenges that COVID-19 has presented to challenge our ability to test, trace, and isolate is the fact, one, that it moves really quickly. It's very transmissible. The second has been the widespread testing that we're trying to ramp up in our country. If you can't identify a case quickly enough, then they will have come into contact with several other people. And then trying to reach those people before they're able to spread it to others. And so that time between diagnosis and actually doing an initial case interview to identify the contacts and then reaching out to those contacts, it really has to move quickly. And COVID-19 has been a challenge to keep up with.
What are some of the best practices to follow then for those who are doing contact tracing for COVID-19?
So the best practices that we have for our contact tracers, a lot of times by the time we get to the contact, they may or may not know that they've been exposed. And so it's really important that they be empathetic and understand that it can be quite a shock sometimes to the people that they're reaching out to. People are very scared about COVID-19 because this is a disease that has never been in our society before, so every person in the population is susceptible to this disease. People are scared. They have a lot of questions. They want to know how long they're going to have to be in isolation. And for a lot of people, that's challenging when they're living paycheck to paycheck, day to day, and then someone's having to tell them that they're going to have to be in isolation for 14 days. So it takes someone who's really empathetic and who can understand the progression of the disease.
Now, you're currently leading a small contact tracing team in your county in Texas. Tell me about how that's going.
So yes, here at Texas A&M, we decided we're here in Brazos County and we needed to do what we could do to help support the local public health effort to do case investigation and contact tracing. So a couple of faculty members and a couple of graduate students are starting a program and we're getting ready to ramp it up to do the contact tracing for the county. One of the things, you know, that we experience, and you can see this in various places around the United States, is we have a very diverse community. So some of the challenges that we deal with is finding people who can speak Spanish in our area, but other languages and other communities also pose that same challenge. Again, trying to get people to identify all of their contacts. You're asking them to remember who all they've been in close contact with for the past 14 days. Sometimes we even manage to get ahead of the process, and we've actually received the report from the testing site or from the provider who did the test that we have a positive COVID case before they've actually been able to reach the case. So we're the ones that are breaking the news to them that they're positive. It's been a mixed bag of experiences, but the one commonality that we work really hard to keep in mind, we're here talking about cases and contacts, but at the end of the day, the cases and contacts are people, and they're people who are probably getting some pretty unsettling news. And so we are reminded constantly of the humanity behind the work that we're doing.
Have you made some of these calls yourself and had to tell people that they are positive?
Yes. Of course, I'm calling about a COVID test. Has anybody contacted you with your results yet? I try to make sure that they've already known, but a lot of times I've had to tell them that they were positive. And of course, it's a difficult conversation, but most of the time they're really grateful just to know and to be empowered, to give them information that gives them some modicum of control over their next 14 days has been kind of humbling.
And then the other calls you're making are saying, listen, you've been in contact with somebody who's positive. Now you need to self-isolate. How do those conversations go?
So our community is a little bit smaller. It's definitely not Houston, Texas. So we've been really fortunate that the vast majority of our contacts had already been told. The actual case is already called. If they knew ahead of time, they've already called for the most part. The reason for this is we have some instances of what we call clustering, where there's two or more people in the same either household or work unit, something like that, that all have it. When you call one of them and say you're positive, you can pretty much know that they're sitting there on the phone with everybody in the household who we would be calling as a contact. And so we're already kind of doing double duty.
Is it tough getting contacts from people so you can then call them to tell them that they were exposed to the virus? Are people reluctant sometimes to share this kind of information?
You know, it varies. I have experienced people who are very open. They're very worried that they've done something to expose the people that they know. And so they're very forthcoming about who they want to help get help notifying about their potential exposure because they feel that sense of responsibility. But there are also times when it is exactly like you say, it is the opposite. They're a little hesitant. Sometimes when we talk to people who perhaps are a little uncertain of their immigration status, they may be a little more reluctant to share information about who they've been with just because they're afraid that we're trying to do something not public health related. Or, you know, they're afraid that if we end up calling other people, then somehow maybe they're not going to be able to go back to work, which they shouldn't be doing. But some of them rely on a day-to-day paycheck. So they're a little hesitant about letting us know of who their contacts are because they don't want it to get out.
Angela Clendenin is an instructional assistant professor in epidemiology and biostatistics at the Texas A&M University School of Public Health. Thanks so much, Angela, for sharing this with us and explaining contact tracing.
Thank you very much, Matt, and y'all stay healthy.
One country ramping up its COVID-19 contract tracing is New Zealand, which has already been heralded as one of the success stories of this pandemic. Enforcing a strict and early lockdown, the country of 5 million kept its total confirmed cases to under 1,200 and total deaths to 21 as of May 19th. But the island nation's wealth and natural isolation also played a big role in keeping the impact low. Tuesday was the second day in a row where the country saw no new reported cases of COVID-19. And the country is moving this week into a new phase where many of its restrictions are being lifted. Schools are back in session, as are retail stores, restaurants, bars, gyms, libraries, and beyond. Earlier this month, when Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern explained what this new Alert Level 2 will look like, she announced this.
You no longer need to stick to your bubble. You can begin seeing family and friends again. We do want you to hang onto the same principles that we are using generally in hospitality, issues around space and hygiene and contact tracing. If we have large-scale events held in people's home, then all of that becomes harder. That is why at Alert Level 2, we are saying that you can have friends and family over to your home, but keep the numbers small.
Here on The Takeaway, we've been checking in with different regions to find out how COVID-19 is affecting them in unique ways. So today, we go to New Zealand with Sarah Robson. She's a senior journalist at Radio New Zealand based in Auckland, and she's with us now. Sarah, thanks so much for bearing with the time difference and joining with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Okay, so Sarah, New Zealand does have a few characteristics that have helped keep the virus relatively at bay. Geography, population density. Your country was, in many senses, set up for success from the start of this, right?
That's right. I mean, New Zealand is an island nation. We are so far away from a lot of those hotspots where we saw COVID-19 take off. But New Zealand moved really quickly in those early stages, back in early February when we first saw the outbreak in Wuhan. New Zealand was one of the first countries to actually put in place travel restrictions out of China. And it wasn't until late February that we actually had our first case, which was a returning traveler from Iran. As the cases took off elsewhere around the country, those travel restrictions just ramped up more and more and more. Jacinda Ardern announced restrictions that basically meant everyone coming into the country had to self-isolate for 14 days. And from there, you know, cruise ships were banned. And just 5 days later, New Zealand's borders were completely closed to everyone but citizens and residents. Jacinda Ardern had to make some really important calls about the next steps to contain it and eventually stamp it out.
Was one of those next steps testing and ramping up a testing program?
Yeah, that is part of it. In the initial stages, the case definition was quite limited. And they had to, if you thought you might have had symptoms, you had to have a link to a confirmed case or have a recent history of overseas travel. But eventually, as the virus was starting to spread and there were indications of community transmission in New Zealand, which was one of the big alarm bells, that testing definition was widened. The message from Jacinda Ardern was fairly clear. If you've got the slightest sniffle, a bit of a tickle in your throat, go out and get tested. And since that has happened, testing numbers have increased quite rapidly and there's no lingering spread of the virus within the community. Our last case of community transmission was back in early April. All of the subsequent cases have been like linked to previous cases or there's been a history of overseas travel. So there's nothing, officials and the Prime Minister are fairly confident there's no COVID-19 lurking out there undetected.
That's quite amazing. What was the difference, do you think, in terms of the capacity for testing? I mean, we've had issues here in the US and just in terms of the number of tests, people have not been able to get tested even if they were ill.
Yes, certainly in the early stages, there were a lot of concerns about New Zealand's capacity to test, like a lot of the rest of the world. But since then, we've had the drive-through clinics, community testing facilities. Out even in rural areas, we've seen mobile testing clinics because health authorities, again, they just really wanted to make sure that there was nothing happening out there that they didn't know about. The virus wasn't spreading out in more remote parts of the country amongst our Indigenous Māori population, who are an incredibly high-risk group. In areas of Auckland and South Auckland, where there's a lot of overcrowding and lower income families, they really needed to make sure that COVID-19 wasn't getting into communities where the spread could be absolutely devastating.
And one of the ways that they're trying to keep the second wave from coming and to maintain this relative stability in terms of preventing COVID-19 and the spread is with contact tracing. So there's a brand new app for contact tracing. Is that right?
Yeah. So it's in its very kind of early stages. I think they wanted to get this app out, encourage businesses to sign up. It's effectively a digital diary. You sign up for it, you enter some of your personal details, and then you will literally just scan a QR code when you're going into a cafe or any other place that you're heading to. That means you've got a record of where you've been, who you might have been in contact with. So if there is a case of COVID-19 and you may have been there, you'll get a push alert to your phone. Or if you end up being confirmed with COVID-19 and you give permission for those details that are recorded in the app to be shared with contact tracers, they will be able to contact anyone you may have been in contact with. 92,000 people of a population of 5 million have signed up for the app so far. They're just getting the word out there to businesses now. So I think we will see uptake increase, I guess, as it becomes more widely known about and more businesses get on board with it. But in the meantime, you know, some businesses are using different QR code systems, different online systems, but some places are even using an old-fashioned pen and paper and collecting details like your name and your phone number on a sheet of paper at the front of the store to comply with those contact tracing requirements.
Sarah, you mentioned Indigenous people in New Zealand. Can you give us a larger sense of what's going on with that population right now?
Yeah, so this has been a really important piece of, I guess, the COVID-19 response. The Indigenous Māori population is overrepresented in a lot of poor health outcomes. Māori are also overrepresented when it comes to unemployment. We've heard a lot over the last few weeks. There's a lingering memory of what happened to Māori during the 1918 influenza pandemic. Obviously, hugely affected by that. And because of that lingering sort of memory and its effect on communities, ensuring that Māori are prioritised in terms of testing and, I guess, a lot of those measures around prevention, getting the messaging out there. Health authorities have really had to work on how to make sure that COVID-19 isn't getting into these remote, poorer, rural, not often with the best health kind of facilities or having to travel a long way to get to see a doctor. So one way that Māori tribes, or iwi as we refer to them here, in more remote areas, they set up their own checkpoints on roads during the lockdown with the support of the police to make sure people coming into the region were meant to be coming into the region, that they weren't, I guess, sort of holiday makers or trying to get to batches or holiday homes. So that was, I guess, one of the effective ways that iwi, local Māori, were able to, I guess, protect their own communities. There was a huge effort in terms of making sure that there was testing happening in some of those more remote Māori communities, and really ramping up, working with iwi Māori leaders to make sure that the messages were getting out there to those communities, to making sure families knew about it and were aware of, you know, physical distancing, the importance of hand washing. The focus now goes on, I guess, the economic recovery and the impact that, I guess, the broader fallout from COVID-19 is going to have on Māori in terms of their employment, their housing, jobs, their general well-being, access to health services, those sorts of broader, wider societal issues that are always present because of, you know, colonization and the way, you know, systems have operated over decades. Māori are often at a disadvantage when a crisis like that hits.
Can you step back for a second and give us a sense of the economic toll that New Zealand has experienced from COVID-19 so far, and how the government has supported the country in terms of backfilling any sort of economic needs that have occurred because of the virus?
The government here acted quite early. Back in mid-March, we saw a $12 billion recovery package announced, a huge focus on looking after the economy, knowing that we are going to go into a recession and a downturn. As part of that, the government has expanded a wage subsidy scheme. Now, that has been a 12-week payment to employers who were likely to lose revenue because of COVID-19. It was supporting wages for employees, and that scheme has so far paid out just under 11 billion New Zealand dollars, and about 1.6 million jobs are being supported by that scheme. Now, I think this is where, when that scheme runs out, that we're going to see the real impact in terms of job losses in New Zealand. We have seen a big increase in the numbers of people going on to our unemployment benefit, but authorities, officials are really expecting, I guess, a second wave again of people losing their jobs, facing redundancy, and needing that income support from the government.
Sarah, I wanted to ask about something that there's been a lot of talk of here, and that's about how countries that have been faring best amidst this crisis are those led by women. Now, that's a complicated thesis, and there's a lot of factors at play, but many people have really commended Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern on her leadership. And I was just wondering if you think there's anything that other countries can learn from her about how to manage a crisis at this moment.
I guess when you reflect on the last, I guess, just over 12 months in New Zealand, we had the terror attacks in Christchurch and now COVID-19. And I guess for a new prime minister, these are two huge, huge things to I guess, deal with so early on in her term of leadership. What's been really, I guess, apparent during COVID-19 and again in the response to the Christchurch mosque attacks is Jacinda Ardern's focus on kindness. One of the big messages at the start of the pandemic was be kind to each other, support one another. We are a team of 5 million. We are staying at home to save lives. And what's interesting as well is there was actually a recent poll that asked people whether they supported the lockdown measures, and that poll found about 90% of New Zealanders supported the lockdown measures. So I think it says a lot, perhaps, about Jacinda Ardern's communication style. We've had these 1 o'clock in the afternoon press conferences with Jacinda Ardern and our Director General of Health, Ashley Bloomfield, who himself has become something of a hero to many members of the New Zealand public. They have together, I guess, clearly laid out the threat posed by COVID-19 and the actions that have needed to be taken to reduce that threat, to deal with the pandemic, and I guess to control the spread of the virus within our country. And I think because that has been so clearly explained to the public in a way that hasn't scaremongered and it's sort of carefully laid out the facts, it has managed to get the vast majority of New Zealanders on board with measures that we would have probably never expected to have taken 3 months ago. The fact that the country almost entirely voluntarily went into a 5-week lockdown, I think, is a testament to the way the risks and the threat posed by COVID-19 has been explained and outlined to the general public. And I guess, you know, Jacinda Ardern has also relied on the science, on the facts, hugely on the advice of Ashley Bloomfield and all the other officials at the Ministry of Health. It's been a really, I guess, measured and grounded in the science and the realities of what's happening, and taking a really good stock take of what the impact would be if action wasn't taken. So decisive action, but with a lot of kindness behind it.
That's an interesting contrast to elsewhere that I'm sure historians will want to study in the future. Thank you very much. Sarah Robson is a senior journalist with Radio New Zealand. Sarah, really appreciate you bringing us this report.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, folks, that's it for today. Before we go, though, we want to thank all of you who have called us with stories of loved ones who have recently passed. We'll be doing a special Memorial Day segment with our friend Anna Sale of the podcast Death, Sex, and Money, when we'll be hearing many of your remembrances. If you'd like to share thoughts about someone who has recently died and what you'd like the world to remember about that person, call us and leave a message at 877-8-MY-TICK. Then listen to our Memorial Day program to hear more. And thank you, as always, for your candor and your thoughtfulness in contributing to this show. We are so grateful. Thanks so much for listening. Until tomorrow, I'm Matt Katz, and this is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Hint Water, makers of fruit-infused water with no sweeteners or calories. Hint's 25 flavors include blackberry, lemon, and new clementine water. In stores or at drinkhint.com. Hint, water with a touch of true fruit flavor.
And Noom. Noom is here for people, providing information about how we can all stay well, physically, mentally, and emotionally, by offering support and guidance to navigate a healthy lifestyle with new challenges. More at Noom.com.